Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The future has arrived without us even noticing. From the self-driving cars and humanoid caretakers in development to the self-propelled vacuum cleaners, hotel delivery bots, and laser surgery assistants already in use, robots today are less the stuff of science fiction than a fact of everyday life. It's clear that these smart machines stand to make some things easier for us, but will they make it harder to get and keep a decent job? Catherine Mangu Ward is managing editor at Reason Magazine, and she wrote the cover story for the April issue, a piece called The Robot Revolution is Here. The issue also features an in-depth interview Mangu Ward did with MIT economist Andrew McAfee on the future of technology. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What counts as a robot? Is it fair to say we know one when we see one?
It absolutely is the kind of thing that we have these warring mental conceptions about. We have this sort of metal man, you know, Terminator picture of a robot. But actually what we're experiencing in day-to-day life is that robots are everywhere hidden, including, for instance, if you use Gmail and you used a tabbed inbox, that's essentially a robot sorting your email for you. So the technical definition that I use in the piece is any entity which is automating a task for you and doing it semi-autonomously.
You open the piece with a little demo performance by a robot waiter called Asimo, who was taking drink orders at a business meeting. This is a simple enough task, but it turns out there are things that this machine can do that a human server could not.
That's right. So actually, the lead of the piece is probably just me venting my frustration with my local Starbucks, to be fair. But what I describe is that the robot, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen one, but they're these sort of small, shiny, white robots. They're like little hobbit-sized creatures. And what the robot does is it walks up to this group of Honda employees and says, you know, can I get you a drink? And they all answer simultaneously. They don't wait for each other. There's no kind of awkwardness. They just say their orders. And then the robot uses its facial recognition to kind of clarify and confirm the order with each person before it heads off to fill the order. And I contrast this with my local Starbucks, where I've been going fairly regularly for 6 years and ordering the same grande mocha extra hot with no whipped cream, and yet they have no idea who I am. So this is kind of the general theme of the piece, which is that, you know, we have this notion that interactions with robots might somehow be less personable or less pleasurable, when in fact, you know, maybe it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, not every human interaction is significant to either party in the transaction.
Right. And this is something that we already experience everywhere. I mean, if you're going into the bank to talk to a teller, it's because something has already gone wrong, right? You know, your life is sort of smoother, easier, better when you can just accomplish that transaction with a machine. And I think increasingly the sort of human as troubleshooter rather than human as first line response is something that we are used to and have come to expect.
And as in the banking business, a lot of this has happened gradually without people freaking out about it. I mean, most people now do most of their bank transactions either, you know, through their phones or computers, or if they have to go to the branch, they do prefer to drive through or walk up to the ATM. The lines are very short now at the teller windows, and they used to be miles long.
Right. And, we are hearing, and it's almost impossible to avoid this kind of, this time it's different. The robot revolution is here. Everything is going to change. But I think people have this idea that, you know, in a minute they're going to turn around and there's going to be an army of Terminators standing behind them. We're already there. The army of Terminators is here. And it turns out what the Terminators want is to, you know, vacuum Cheerios out of my rug and you know, give you cash.
Well, let's talk about those little robot vacuums, because they're probably the things that Americans today are most likely to have contact with are those little Roombas. And I think there's some other brands as well. They probably have put some house cleaners out of work. But, you know, you point out that maybe washing machines and dishwashers did the same thing in their day.
Right. So there's absolutely a continuum here. And I there is something a little bit different about the Roomba. There's a reason that it sort of is forced into doing so much work in this debate because it is the kind of domestic robot of our dreams in some ways. I have a Roomba, so I guess I'm biased, but the one thing that's kind of striking about it is, you know, yes, perhaps it is putting a house cleaner out of a job, but more likely, you know, I wasn't going to hire someone to come into my house every evening and vacuum. I was going to do it myself, right? So you can see it as putting someone out of a job, or you can see it as me using my own time to do something a little more productive, or maybe just read BuzzFeed articles.
Yeah, that's the question, is what we do with all this extra time, because I have a house full of, like, appliances that, you know, I don't have to scrub the family's laundry on a board or do any of those things. And yet I feel like I spend a decent amount of time cleaning my house. And it's not like we feel as if we have a whole lot more free time.
Right. And that's something that I think when people, you know, this is the where's my jetpack phenomenon.
Right.
You know, we were promised a glorious future of no drudge work and infinite leisure. At the same time, when you present people with a vision of a world where labor-saving devices are common and, in fact, replace ordinary human jobs, that suddenly seems really threatening. So there's this kind of, we're caught between a rock and a hard place of wanting this kind of gentle utopian future with no labor and also, you know, wanting something for people to do all day and get paid to do.
Tell us about the study at Oxford that looked at hundreds of occupations in the U.S. today and projected which ones could be eliminated by automation.
Right. So this is it's a little bit of a controversial study I found as I was reporting the piece. But you know, somebody inevitably has taken the time to sort of count up all the jobs that are out there and say, okay, realistically speaking, what are we replacing and what, you know, what is it that we can't expect to replace? You know, I think the trouble with the study is that it suggests that we know what robots are coming next. You know, I think if you look at kind of futuristic essays from decades ago, one thing that's really notable is that nobody predicted the internet correctly, or almost nobody. Maybe Neil Stephenson gets a little credit in Snow Crash, but basically we're terrible at seeing the future sometimes. And this is one of those ways, is the ways in which automation is going to change our lives. So, yeah, I guess I would kind of raise a question about that study, but I would say, you know, even there, they ended up saying something like, I think 40%, 47% of jobs are replaceable by robots, but not maybe entirely. Job functions are different than jobs themselves.
One fascinating element of conversations about the U.S. manufacturing industry is that while lots of people lament the hemorrhaging of factory jobs over the course of the 20th century, the manufacturing sector itself is still really strong in America today. It's just that we've put 1 million robots to work in those factories instead of like 50 million humans or whatever it would be.
Right. And this is something that I think, again, this is it's a little bit about what our kind of science fiction imagining of the future looked like. It's very easy for us to say, oh, I see how it is that these giant assembly lines, the things that humans do on them can soon be things that robots do in them or perhaps already are. And that's kind of easy to envision, you know, but what we don't envision is stuff like robots decorating cakes. And I actually really recommend if you're sort of sitting in front of your computer right now, listeners, go just do a YouTube search for videos of cake decorating robots, which is like hypnotic and beautiful. It's this kind of strange art form. And that kind of thing, which we think of as something that requires a human touch, does get replaced. So we have this kind of hard industry manufacturing thing, which politicians love to demagogue because we like to think of ourselves as making stuff in this country and in lots of countries. But at the same time, we also have those exact same robots, those sort of articulated robotic arms, you know, writing happy birthday on 1,000 cakes.
And of course, robots may also eliminate a lot of jobs that, granted, paid people a wage, but weren't particularly satisfying in terms of, you know, people's ability to avoid boredom on the job, that sort of thing. Robots can do a lot of really tedious tasks and not complain.
Right. There's, for instance, again, I clearly spent a lot of time on YouTube researching this piece. There are videos of robots that all they do is take a sort of disordered pile of batteries and stack them into those the little rows of batteries that you're used to seeing in the kind of bubble seal packs, right? Like, nobody wants that job. People want jobs, but nobody's like, oh, I want to be a battery stacker when I grow up.
Right.
And I think that's something that Andrew McAfee, in my interview in this piece, the MIT researcher, and also people like Charles Murray, who's written about the kind of coming apart of, you know, blue collar workers versus white collar workers. They sort of want to valorize work. They want to say, well, it's important for people to have a job just because work itself is good. But I think, you know, it's pretty hard to sort of keep a straight face and say that to the battery stacker.
It's easy to imagine how a robot might be programmed to spray paint auto parts, or now that you've mentioned it, decorate a cake, or assemble computer chips. But there are other jobs that we just assume that a human has to do that could easily be outsourced to robots. And you write about this hotel chain that's starting to put little robots in place to deliver like a toothbrush or a razor to individual rooms when you've forgotten to pack one.
Right. So this is the Butler robot, which is in the Starwood hotel chain. It's being tried out in some locations in the Starwood hotel chain. And yeah, it does exactly that. And of course, hotels are a wonderful test case because, you know, they're a very predictable environment, right? The floors are, you know, every room is numbered. The layouts are all the same in each room. And the number of things that people need in a hotel, frankly, like the list is pretty short. So a lot of people forget their toothbrushes. Not that many people are like, you know, can you get me 3 ferrets and a begonia on short notice? And it's a great testing ground for these robots. And again, you know, I feel like I'm coming off as a, you know, an unpleasant person in this interview, but it's awkward when somebody shows up at your hotel room door and your legs are sticking out of the bottom of that fluffy white robe and you're like, thanks for the toothbrush. And it's much better, I think. Again, you can see the value of actually having one less human interaction in your day. You know, much better that something should just roll up to the door, hand you your toothbrush and roll away.
What are developers and companies using these things learning about how comfortable consumers feel actually interacting with them?
So there's a whole sort of burgeoning field of sort of social robotics, and this is actually a place where I think people are it's a little more reasonable to have some qualms, because what's going on in that field is that they are essentially trying to figure out how to make machines seem like they care about people, so that people will care back about machines. And that does start to sound a little manipulative and alarming, but again, it's something that we actually all benefit from, and there are examples of that. Everything from there's these little robotic seals, these sort of white pet seals that they give to people who are older people in like assisted living facilities, to give them something to kind of care for and bond with. But if you think about it, it is a bit creepy, right? It's a machine that's been programmed to make you think it loves you. And frankly, I feel that way about my Roomba, and so do my kids, right? Like, my son, you know, gets down, and my Roomba lives under my sofa. My son gets down and, like, calls to the Roomba to come play with him under the sofa. And the Roomba's not even trying very hard to seem lovable. Imagine what would happen if you tried.
Right. And let's face it, the Roomba will vacuum under the sofa, where you'd be like, nobody sees that spot. And if you were cleaning, you probably wouldn't even get to it.
Absolutely.
We're speaking this hour with Catherine Mangue Ward. She's managing editor at Reason Magazine. She wrote the cover story for the April issue. It's called The Robot Revolution is Here. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can email the show, think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/cpfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the managing editor of Reason magazine, Catherine Mangu Ward. She wrote the cover story for the April issue, The Robot Revolution is Here. She also has a one-on-one interview about whether robots will take our jobs. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Catherine, how does the initial cost of these machines compare with the expense of hiring a human to do the same work over a matter of months or years?
Well, one thing that we've seen is that there's really been a gradualist approach to building in these costs. So one place you can see this is driverless cars, which is another area where robots are becoming kind of increasingly visible. Elon Musk recently noted that his cars, the Tesla cars, were basically just a software update away from becoming driverless cars. And that's increasingly true of luxury cars of all kinds. So instead of saying to people, okay, well, you have your old-fashioned car and now you have to lay out a bunch of cash for a robot car, manufacturers are just adding the features slowly to various things in our lives, and then at some point it just becomes kind of an inevitability. We see that also with software, like as I mentioned before, your Google, you know, your Gmail inbox, which admittedly was free to begin with, now has a free robot hiding inside, and that's I think more the pattern that we're seeing. Of course, with manufacturing, it's different. That is kind of upfront cost.
It makes perfect sense to do it gradually. And frankly, if the kind of car that parallel parked itself were in my price range, I would buy one in a heartbeat.
I absolutely give credence to the myths of lady drivers. So I too would like to take a blow for reducing sexism by taking the wheel out of my hands.
And the funny thing is, we get really nervous about the idea of just getting in a car and taking our hands off the wheel and instructing a car to drive us somewhere. And yet we don't bat an eyelash at the fact that when we step onto a commercial airliner, most of the time we're in the air, the pilots are not directly in charge of the path of flight.
Right. And I think part of that has to do with, you know, what's directly in front of us. We sort of don't know what's going on in the cockpit, so we choose not to know. But in my interview with Andrew McAfee, one thing he says that I thought was really interesting is you get in a, you know, he had a chance to ride in one of the driverless cars that Google is developing. He said, you get in there, they push the big red button on the dashboard, which is real. There's literally a giant red give my car to the robots button. And for one moment, it's exhilarating because, oh, my God, no one's driving the car. And then it quickly becomes incredibly boring because, you know, these cars, they're really, they're conservative drivers. They follow the law, which, you know, frankly, I don't. So there's this very, very fast kind of learning curve or kind of adaptation that where we go from this is incredibly novel and scary to, oh, of course, this is the new normal.
So the day might come when it's a special skill to know how to drive in the way that it's a special skill to know how to ride a horse today.
In fact, there's been a lot of commentary about how it may at some point be illegal to drive yourself, or certainly might be illegal in certain contexts. You can imagine saying, okay, on a busy interstate at rush hour, letting human, you know, fallible humans take the wheel of the car comes to represent a sort of intolerable risk. And actually, my colleague Ron Bailey, who's Reason's science correspondent, has written a lot about how there's good reason to think that not only will driverless cars be safer, but that they may actually be more ethical, that you can program in consistent, principled decision-making to a car in a way that you really can't rely on a human.
Yeah, a computer's not going to have road rage and just suddenly tailgate somebody because they've made you mad.
Right. And the computer is, well, I guess the computer is going to text while it's driving you, but that is not going to tax its capacities.
Right. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Janet on the line in Dallas. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
You just brought up another subject while I was listening about this. You know, the car driver won't have road rage. You know, I wanted to go back to what Catherine was talking about with social robots. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I had a block of time where I didn't hear what you were talking about. You might have said this, but Sherry Turkle is a psychologist at MIT who has studied children with respect to, you know, computerized mediums throughout the last 30 years. And at MIT, the people are also working on, and Turkle says, we're ready because of the digitized society we live in. Our reality is mediated everywhere we go. People are ready for relationships, to have a relationship with a robot, up to the point of even a sexual relationship. I mean, that's what futurists are envisioning. And when, Catherine, you made the comment that said, well, imagine this robot is sitting across from you and it's being programmed to care for you. I sometimes think, imagine the people who sit across from you who pretend to care about you, the humans, and what you invest in all of that. So if you imagine a robot as a roommate or a social mate, I mean, it's not that unusual. Now that we've lived in this society of everything is digitized, the world is not messy anymore, you know? We text, we don't talk, people don't talk on the phone hardly anymore. They don't have social conversations hardly anymore.
A lot of interesting points.
They don't want the mess.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call, Janet. There's a lot that Janet brought up there, Catherine. Is there anything you want to respond to?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole idea of these social robots does take advantage of exactly what the caller is describing, which is that humans already have this incredible capacity to project their own feelings or responses onto other humans. So all we have to do is give them something that looks and acts enough like a human for that to kick in. And that's what we see and have always seen. I mean, it's not as if, you know, somebody woke up in 1982 and said, hey, we should have, you know, robotic human-shaped things around in our world. This is something that we've been thinking about as a species for a really long time, and we are built to relate to human-like things, whether or not they want to relate to us.
We tend to lionize doctors in our culture, but they are fallible human beings, just like everybody else in every other profession. What kinds of things will medical robots do for us in the near future?
Well, I guess I can start by saying what medical robots have already done for me, which is given me 20/20 vision. I am a happy customer of laser eye surgery, of LASIK, and I got it done quite a long time ago in 2002. And at the time, my strongest impression of the whole thing was, I'm laying there, I've got the kind of clockwork orange, things holding open my eyelids, and the doctor, you know, is chatting with me while I smell burning. And she's asking me about whether or not a restaurant in New Haven, a hamburger restaurant in New Haven, is still open, because she and I had both gone to college in the same place. And I'm like, can we just focus on my eyeballs for a minute, because I'm not comfortable talking about hamburgers right now. And of course, what I realized is, you know, she wasn't doing anything. The robot was doing the surgery, and that in fact that was much better, because the robot could adjust to the minute movements of my eyes during the surgery quite easily, whereas a human would have quite a lot of trouble with that. And we're seeing that in all kinds of places. Those of you who watched the Jeopardy contest where Watson faced off against human Jeopardy champs, IBM's computer Watson. Watson is now in medical school. So, the same kind of computer brain is being used to digest the full contents of PubMed and Medline, which are the two kind of databases of medical journals. And already Watson is, for instance, much better at detecting lung cancer than human radiologists when looking at scans.
And of course, when you type in a list of symptoms to a specially designed software application, it can draw on a lot more than the most brilliant medical mind can do, at least for an initial suggestion of what might be wrong.
Right. And this is something that human doctors are notoriously not very fond of, which is the patient who comes in with the diagnosis from Dr. Google.
From Google, right.
But actually, for people who do have rare conditions and not just the all too common condition of hypochondria, the internet and sort of being able to use natural language search terms is a tremendous boon, not just for finding an actual diagnosis, but also for finding, for instance, communities of people like themselves. So this idea that, again, you know, you it's just become normal. But what that is like a personal assistant who happens to have incredible expertise in, you know, rare medical problems, who, you know, also schedules you, you know, a nice social outing with other people who have those same problems.
How are industries that are being affected by this changing the way they hire and the sort of shifting obligations of people? It occurred to me that the last year I paid an accountant to do my taxes was 2003, despite having the typical journalist math skills, because I have TurboTax. And it didn't occur to me that I was putting an accountant out of work, but certainly all the people that are doing that add up over time.
Right. And I think, you know, that's something where we, you know, there's the sort of the seen and the unseen here, right? So it's easy to see that you're not sort of schlepping a giant pile of paper to your accountant anymore and hoping that some collection of the receipts that you throw at them winds up being the right one, but instead that you're using TurboTax. But what we don't see is that there, you know, somebody has to not only kind of do the initial build of that software, but also that, you know, there's this continual improvement of the kind of robot replacements. And, you know, it doesn't replace the, you know, it's not as if you can just take all the people who used to be accountants and say, okay, now go design tax software. But the idea that it's only destruction, I think, is somewhat misguided, that, you know, there are good reasons to say, well, listen, this just means we should train fewer accountants and train more people to do the kind of creative thinking that winds up with the, you know, the cool app that you can just take a picture of your W-2 and it files your taxes for you.
There are some kinds of creative thinking that are getting outsourced to machines. I was reading this thinking, well, the humanities are safe, right? But as it turns out, people are coming up with, I guess, software algorithms that might put some copywriters out of work.
Right. So this was, I obviously felt in order to do the fairest version of this piece, I had to give a good look at which robots would eventually replace me. And that is, they're out there already. There are a couple of different companies, including one called Journatic, which extracts hyper-local news from a bunch of different data sources and turns it into the kind of stories that you would read in your local paper or on a local website. This is stuff like estate sales, right? I mean, again, it's you know, we're sort of verging into the territory of, you know, work humans don't want to do. you know, my very first job out of college was at a local paper where I wrote up the police blotter. And, you know, I'm not saying I didn't do my best, but I think a computer probably could have done a better job just due to the sheer boringness of the whole thing. So I think, you know, again, you know, what we're seeing is that there are, in fact, computers replacing those roles. At the same time, at least for now, another company, Persado, they, you know, it's computer generated news, but they are they posted a listing recently saying, basically, you know, they raised a bunch of money. What were they going to use the money for? Venture capital money to hire humans to sell this software and to teach people how to use it. So again, it's a sort of, you know, some jobs disappear, but others are created.
We have an email here from Chris in Dallas who says, isn't all this leading to more social isolation, even less real community, and even more bowling alone or bowling with my robot than we've already seen?
Bowling with a robot sounds awesome, first of all. I would love to do that, partially because I assume I could program the robot to be like just a little bit worse than I am at bowling, and the robot wouldn't be embarrassed or at least less embarrassed. No, I mean, I think there is always this tendency when parts of our lives are invaded by technology to say, oh, it's dehumanizing. But, you know, I think at the same time, you know, another example that I cite in the article is I have a drop cam, which is just a little Wi-Fi enabled camera. I have young children, so I use it as a baby monitor, essentially. Mm-hmm. And one thing that it lets me do is I can take my phone, which has the video feed on it, and I can pop over to my next door neighbor's house and have a drink with them at the end of the day while both of our kids are in bed. So I think that's a great example where, well, we really could have just been sitting in our respective houses side by side because someone had to be there listening to see if the baby wakes up. And instead, we're like hanging out together on the porch. So there are ways in which technology facilitates connection. And I think the internet, of course, is the big story of that. You can say, yes, everyone's just sitting in their basement lit by the sad blue glow of the screen. Or you can say, isn't it wonderful that people are connecting hundreds of times a day on Twitter and Facebook and via email?
I was fascinated to read in your piece that even such luminaries as Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking are worried about artificial intelligence.
Right. So this is the nuclear scenario, right? So these are people who are famously introducing robotics into everyday life, or sort of providing theoretical backing for ways to do that. But there was a statement that was signed on to by quite a lot of big names, which basically said the potential benefits are huge, but on the other hand, we should probably be worried that they're all going to rise up and kill us. And this is the quote that I think was from Musk was something like, we've discovered that robots or computers are incredibly efficient at eliminating, say, spam from email. What happens if they decide that we're the spam?
Of course, it does reveal like an inherent human insecurity, doesn't it? That we assume that we can make a machine that recognizes that we're flawed, but no other people realize that. Only these hyper-intelligent machines will figure that out.
Right. I mean, certainly we have intelligent machines that have been trying to eliminate flawed people for a long time. It's people. But I'm actually, I'm quite an optimistic person. And, I go along really with Marc Andreessen, who famously invented the web browser and is now a venture capitalist. And he has basically said, listen, if we put in the hands of people these incredibly powerful tools, if you give everyone the means of production, it's crazy to think that they won't do new, impressive, resourceful, economically stimulating things with those tools. And I think that's what we're going to see.
Catherine Mengu Ward is here. She's managing editor at Reason Magazine, and she wrote the cover story for the April issue. It's called The Robot Revolution is Here. If you would like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the future of robots, computers, and automation with the managing editor at Reason Magazine, Catherine Mengu Ward. Her cover story for the April issue is called The Robot Revolution is Here. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Jim on the line in Carrollton. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I had a conversation with my brother about this subject you were talking about just before the break. Artificial intelligence, robotics, people being afraid that robots are going to take over the world. And I told him that I don't see that as possible because they won't have a survival instinct, they won't have an ego, and they won't have emotions. They will have no drive to take over the world. Why would they want to? And I don't think that they would really think the way we think. They would do something more like simulate thinking so that you couldn't tell. Do you agree with that?
I always want to take my cues from Isaac Asimov wherever possible here. And I think that, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between doing a really good job of simulating the way humans act and just being human in his stories. That depending on whose thesis you buy on this, maybe actually human behavior is just that, right? That it's essentially our genes tricking us into thinking that we feel feelings and hold principles and act accordingly, when in fact we're just sort of these devices to carry our genes into perpetuity. So I guess I would say... I do not rule out the possibility that we could build robots that, you know, accidentally believe that they totally need to kill us all. But at the same time, that you are right to be skeptical that, you know, people are hyper aware of this concern. And there are some very, very smart people thinking about how to prevent, you know, the gray goo scenario where the nanobots eat us all.
It's probably a conversation for another day, but it does, you know, it calls into question this idea that, like, we have free will. If we can be so sure that because of their programming, robots don't have free will, then we have to ask about, you know, our biological programming and the question of whether or not we really make as many decisions as we believe we do.
Right. And I think that is one reason that this debate makes so many people uncomfortable, because you start to realize there isn't quite as much daylight between, you know, a really excellent, you know, robot that's programmed to think to make, say, patients in a hospital believe that they are that they've sort of developed a relationship with their nurse, and an actual nurse who doesn't really care about her patients, but has lots of behaviors to make them think that she cares about them.
Yeah, or cares in the abstract, maybe, but, you know, just basically has to get through the day.
Right.
Certainly. And there are a lot of things that robots might do to monitor people's health and well-being that right now it would be prohibitively expensive to put a human in place to do.
Right. And so this is actually to go ahead and promote the next issue of Reason magazine, which is about the sort of pervasiveness of the Internet and government attempts to regulate it. We have a great piece in there about the rise of all these different wearables. Right. So your Fitbit, essentially. And now I suppose your Apple Watch, which is going to be consuming a huge amount of data about you. You know, one thing that, of course, again, science fiction writers love to think about is, you know, at what point do we have enough data about someone to create a convincing facsimile of that person? Mm. And then what does that look like? Again, we are so far from there right now. I should emphasize that even though I do think the robot revolution is already here, convincing humanoid android robots are not upon us yet, but yeah, it's something that's certainly not impossible coming down the line. And when you see some of the really fantastic artificial limbs that that we're building, as well as the totally alarming pack bots that the Department of Defense and DARPA have developed, which are sort of these animal-like machines that run across different terrain, we're getting there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Mike in Plano. Hi, Mike.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to bring up security. You know, we've had numerous breaches in information databases for healthcare and in banking. You know, recently we've had those headlines, and I just wanted to mention, what if we had all these self-driving cars on the road? You know, we're always finding security flaws in software. What if a hacker managed to, you know, hack into one of these self-driving cars or manipulate the code? Whose fault would that be? And how far do you think we are from figuring out the legislative implications of that?
Yeah, the question of liability for driverless cars is something that a lot of people are worried about. I think that it's solvable perhaps in the short run just through the kind of arbitrary expedient of something similar to a terms of service agreement, right? So we have a sort of elaborate legal system that deals with liability right now, and we simply accept that courts or legislatures have designated someone who is liable, even when sometimes lots of people could be liable. So you can imagine a scenario where you get into your driverless car and a little screen pops up that says, do you accept liability for whatever this car does? And you say, yes, I do. And then we can sort of continue with our current liability scenario as is. As for the sort of security vulnerability question, one thing that I think is really fantastic about where the driverless car industry is right now is that there are a bunch of competitors. There are lots of different companies really working to get into this space. So if the Google driverless car turns out to have a terrible security flaw, a weakness, you better believe people are going to stop buying Google driverless cars and buy another kind. And that's, you know, that's the sort of beauty of a market that's competitive and that's in flux, is You know, a bad product can be replaced with a good one.
Do you happen to know if I know the prototypes in development could be really different from whatever is actually produced eventually, but are these thought of as like little covered pods for a person or two so that, you know, I could send one kid to soccer practice and one kid to play rehearsal and one kid to work? Or will these be large enough to carry, you know, a number of people at a time?
I think, I mean, all of the above are in development. The one, you know, the one that you can most easily find publicity photos of is the Google driverless car, which it's a smart car. So it's essentially kind of a two-seater. But another model to think about is the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, has said he's built into his model is that everything that Uber does will expand in two different directions. The first is Uber should become a point-to-point sort of system to ferry anything or anyone to anywhere. So that means trucks, that means motorcycles, that means, you know, little pods, whatever. And also that he expects for it all to be automated eventually. So you can imagine kind of, you know, in the way now, if you're an Uber user, you open up your phone and you say, oh, do I want an Uber X or do I want an Uber taxi or do I want Uber Black? You know, also maybe Uber moving truck and Uber, you know, drone.
Would be interesting if those self-driving cars like refuse to go out in certain conditions that, you know, humans shouldn't be driving in either, but typically do.
Well, I think we would see that, actually. This gets back to my colleague Ronald Bailey's argument about driverless cars actually being more ethical and rational than human drivers. You can easily imagine a fleet of driverless cars saying essentially like, no, these are terrible driving conditions. Absolutely not. And then you just walk or you stay home. I can understand why that might be kind of grating or alarming to some who want to say, listen, at some point you got to let people make bad choices. But and I'm sympathetic to that view. But these are also bad choices that impact other people, that could result in, you know, in someone being killed in an accident, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's a case to be made that and this needn't be necessarily a legal requirement. Right. It could just be that the manufacturers of these cars will say, you know, we don't want the bad publicity that's going to come when one of our cars skids off the road. So we're you know, putting the fleet in dock until the snow stops.
So this wasn't one of your two articles in this issue, but as editor, I'm sure you've read it. Elizabeth Nolan Brown has a piece about sex bots. And just in general terms, how likely is it that this will be something that is considered socially acceptable in the future for people who are not partnered up or who are partnered up but are with someone who is not interested in doing what a sex bot will do?
Right. So Elizabeth's piece is just I think it's a really great piece, partially because it asks this very difficult question, which is, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, you know, is sex with a sex bot cheating, or is it like having, looking at pornography, or is it like owning a vibrator? And there's a lot of ethical, gray area there. And we don't really know how people are going to view it in the future. She sort of says that, for now, the technology is not there yet. We are not to the point where people would be able to really confuse a relationship with a sex bot with one with a human. But she raises, robot brothels. You know, how do we feel about a scenario where, the sort of consumer experience could be very similar, but without having to put humans in the position to provide those services?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Kelly in Louisville next. Hi, Kelly.
Yes. Hello. I'd like to expand on the previous caller's point about the difference between a simulation or simulated thought and actual thought. And the point that I'd like to make is that we don't make this confusion with any other phenomena. So, for instance, no matter how perfect a simulation of fire we were able to create, we would never think that we would be able to roast a marshmallow with it, because we can easily distinguish between the simulation and reality. But for some reason, when it comes to thought, and especially consciousness, we fall into this trap of confusing the simulation with reality.
Well, I think in the case of robots, maybe we're not building a fire; we're just building a hot plate. I mean, you know, I think you can't. You know, maybe the thing that you're that we're substituting for a kind of natural phenomenon isn't necessarily a perfect facsimile, and that we wouldn't necessarily confuse it, but it might get the same job done. And we can see that for everything from, there's nobody sitting at my desk sorting my email, but a robot is doing that for me, all the way up through our robot brothels.
STEM jobs are very important now. They will continue to be important into the future, but surely they won't be the only ones. What, though, does all of the reporting that you've done suggest about the things we need to include in a standard education in this country?
The thing that really stood out to me in my reporting on this was virtually everyone who was looking in this area said two things. One, we need to stop teaching people facts because robots can fetch those for us. And this is also a sort of science fiction dream. But even there, I don't think we adequately anticipated the extent to which you just don't need to keep stuff in your brain, including facts about, like, what time is my interview with KERA? Like, my phone just told me before I came here. I didn't need to know it. And so I think that's a direction we're already moving in terms of education, is just away from the kind of accumulating of information and toward sort of a way of building frameworks or useful tools for assimilating information when it arrives. But the other thing is entrepreneurialism, which is, so far there is no such thing as a robot businessman. And people who look at robotics are saying, that's the last place they can see us going. That's the most difficult thing. So I think just an increasing emphasis on kind of not only economic literacy and financial literacy so that, business ideas can come to fruition, but also the kind of flexible and open thinking that we value in entrepreneurs. And that includes not just our education system, but also our immigration system to sort of say, let's let in people with ideas for businesses, and then we can, let the robot armies execute them.
And we will continue to need people with the skills to interact successfully with other people.
Right. And that's something that, there is this fear, this sort of, well, what if humans become obsolete everywhere? And every time a robot gets good at something, I think we have this fear like, oh, God, this fear of human usefulness is shrinking. When in fact, no one that I know shows any signs of actually ceasing to interact with humans. We for some reason, we like each other. And I think, just because a robot is getting us our cash at the bank or vacuuming our floor or, keeping a robot eye on our children doesn't mean that we have somehow forfeited our humanity.
Catherine Mengu Ward is managing editor at Reason Magazine, and she wrote the cover story for the April issue, a piece called The Robot Revolution is Here. The issue also includes other articles on the topic. Catherine, it's been a really interesting hour, and I so appreciate you making time for us.
Thank you for having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.